What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, this was such an interesting topic. I don't know how many other podcasts have ever delved into the notion of whether all of North America is going to be habitable given climate change going forward. But John, I had read an article in The Week, which is one of my favorite publications that I get every week. I used to always get Newsweek, John, but now I get The Week. And it does a great job of summarizing some of the great writing across the country. And I thought this was a fascinating piece because I had never really thought about it. For example, John, Phoenix, that area this summer had temperatures cresting at about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Can you imagine we're headed here?
Well, that's hot in that desert there. Well, you know, the only thing you hear about is the oceans rising, which would mean that the shoreline communities are probably in trouble. But you don't think about, out there in the desert being so hot. Wow.
Well, 130 degrees in Death Valley over the summer. You have droughts. You've got massive hurricanes, forest fires. You've got a whole raft of things going on. I remember Pete Buttigieg, when he was running, talking about the fact that he had had, I think, in the community of, West Bend, Indiana, I think it was 3 100-year storms and floods in the span of 5 years.
Yeah, this is something that we got to take a serious look at. I guess we are today on America Trends because nobody's really talking about that. I mean, that part of the equation.
Well, remember after Hurricane Sandy, I recall that New York discussed fortification, barriers, seawalls for these low-lying areas, but never abandonment of the entire area. But, John, I think we're going to have to be thinking about new strategies because let's think about this. How many people are really going to be able to get a mortgage in a place where, well, the company says, well, I'm looking at trends here, and I don't like the way it's going in your neck of California. I don't know that we want to write you a mortgage, let alone find an insurance company down the road that wants to insure that property.
Wow, yeah, I never even thought of that side of it. If you can't get insurance or you can't get a mortgage, then who's going to live there?
Exactly, and don't forget, John, after Hurricane Andrew in Florida years back, and I found this amazing in my research for this podcast, they had to go and establish a state-run insurance program because there were no insurers who wanted to come into Florida in that area because of the severity of that storm.
Wow. Well, I think insurance in Florida right now is very expensive to get, like flood insurance and stuff in Florida, if not impossible. You know, you're kind of on your own a little bit there with that.
Oh, exactly. And you know, the thing that I find most interesting when we have this conversation with Jesse Keenan, now he's our guest today, and he's a specialist in this area. He teaches at Tulane University. We'll give a more apt description when we have him on the line. But what's really fascinating is, guess where Americans in general, John, are moving?
Well, I would say if you're worried about climate change, maybe the Midwest would be the place to be.
Well, you're right going forward, but they're still moving to these areas that are going to be the hardest to find habitable going forward because they're desirable. They want to go to the shore. They want to go to Louisiana and be down in New Orleans, or they want to go to Phoenix, all these great growth areas.
Right, right.
That's where we're going to have the trouble.
Oh, well, they're already having. I mean, down in Louisiana, they're they're getting hurricane after hurricane. I mean, they were already having troubles down there.
Oh, exactly. All the barrier islands and such have all been washed away. I mean, it's an incredible issue. It really is. So let's delve into it, John. And by the way, you are exactly right about the Midwest. And Jesse Keenan tells us about the most desirable place in America in the next 30, 40 years. And you're not going to believe what it is. But I will say this. If you're a fan of Fargo, it's not far away.
We'll be corn farming.
All right. Jesse Keenan next on America Trends. With us on America Trends is Jesse Keenan, and he's an urban planning and climate change specialist who advises the Federal Commodity Futures Trading Commission on market hazards from climate change. He's also an associate professor of real estate at Tulane University School of Architecture. And the question we're going to grapple with today on the podcast is, what happens when states across this country are no longer habitable because of climate change? Now, Professor Keenan, how likely is that scenario, and over what time frame?
Well, I think it's in terms of space and geography, I think it's worth reflecting that in the coming generation, this is a multi-generational set of challenges that we have, of course, but leading to the end of the century, it's not that entire states will be uninhabitable, but there will certainly be regions, in terms of very localized areas, of course, but there will certainly be regions that will have measures of depopulation, as well as an exit of capital, that's human capital, financial capital, and even environmental capital, as we see greater grain shifting of flora and fauna and people and economies following behind that. So I think we already are seeing now certainly measures of displacement, what we call climate migration or climate migration, happening domestically in very localized areas. And we would anticipate that this would accelerate with the advent of not just sea level rise, but extreme precipitation leading to new zones of risk in terms of flooding, in terms of droughts, and really in terms of extreme heat, which is actually often unappreciated in terms of the impact that that has, particularly on labor economies and human health. So there's many range of impacts that drive people's decision making when it comes to mobility, and not just in terms of mobility as a transportation sense, but mobility more broadly in terms of where and how they intend to lead their lives and shape their community. So this is a multi-generational challenge, and it's something that we will be dealing with. Of course, we're dealing with it now, but we will be dealing with it with greater measure of intensity and severity in the coming decades.
Is it fair to say that this phenomenon is already underway in some of the poorest and hottest parts of the world? I know the term climate refugees is now part of the lexicon. Can you identify some of those places for us?
Well, climate refugees are distinct from climate migration. I think that as a recognition of both legal, technical sort of verbiage and more academic orientations, I think climate migrants are really the preferred sort of way to frame this, because refugees, and then the idea of refugees under international law, has a very peculiar and specific meaning of application. And frankly, much of the anticipated movement of people is actually not going to be transnational, which would trigger a sort of refugee classification, but it's actually going to be intranational or intra-country. In fact, the vast majority of climate migration, as it is currently sort of understood or anticipated, will actually happen quite locally. But I think when we're talking about Sub-Saharan Africa, certain parts of Western Asia and the Caucasus, areas where we have desertification and urbanization and desertification meeting and running up against each other, we have challenges not only to human health and supply chains of food and the collapse of food webs and things like that, but there's also underlying measures associated with water scarcity. And I would say that, you know, food, water are part and parcel, but it's really water scarcity, I think, is a sort of more proximate challenge to driving human mobility and human migration, is really probably one of the more immediate challenges.
In America, when we see things like California's broken electrical grid, the hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth. I think it was 130 degrees in Death Valley. Droughts, you mentioned, massive hurricanes, forest fires, as a harbinger, or is it a present reminder that we've almost arrived at a place where we really have to consider a lot of our movement? And it's interesting that in America, seemingly, people are still moving predominantly to these areas that are going to be most affected.
Well, it's interesting. I think where we are and where we stand today is the manifestation of a new normal or a new baseline. And I think what's difficult for many of us who think about this perhaps in historical terms relative to settlement patterns is we tend to think that we overlook the resetting of the new normal, right? That the benchmark keeps changing. I think we're at this pivotal moment now where the cascading nature of hazards and events and perils are meeting the ongoing stress of climate change. And I think we tend, in popular terms, to look at the shocks and to look at failures as a means that we think is driving things. But I think it's also the stress that comes along with climate change, the chronic aspects of climate impact that are actually interacting with the shocks in ways that are driving new recognition of what the scope of the challenges are. And I think when we think about this in terms of settlement and housing, and we think about vulnerability, there isn't always an alignment between poverty and vulnerability. So just because you're poor doesn't necessarily mean you're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But I think where we are, and I think California is probably representative of this, is that, you know, the relationship between housing affordability and environmental exposure in terms of land and land economies are more clear now than ever, which is that, and this is certainly the foundation originating sort of illogic of environmental justice, of course, which is that higher risk land, that is land that has higher risk to environmental exposure, such as in the wild urban interface, is just lower cost than more urbanized areas. And that people in not just, you know, middle class, lower middle class, really middle America is being pushed out of these areas, such as out of the Bay Area, and they're being pushed into these lower cost areas by means of just having more accessible housing or access to more newer housing stock that just happens to be being built into these areas. So I think this relationship between affordability, our own sort of standards of consumption and housing consumption, and environmental risk and exposure are all sort of coalescing into a recognition that, you know, just because you can buy a bigger house or a cheaper house or a better quality house within something like the wild urban interface doesn't necessarily mean that doesn't come with an additional cost. And that may be the cost of increased insurance or lack of insurance in some places, may come at the cost of losing your abode entirely. So this is the relationship. I think it's more clear now than ever.
What about when does something like this really begin to seep into the consciousness of the American public? For example, if in fact a lot of the concerns that we have often swept under the rug, and we see that during the pandemic, involve the poorest among us, and we haven't worried about some of these social determinants of health, when it begins to impinge upon the middle class and the wealthy. And I know I was talking to a cousin in California recently, and forest fires were beckoning. I mean, they were almost on their doorstep. They were preparing to leave. Now, this is Los Altos Hills, one of the most exclusive communities in all of the country. I mean, is that when certain things begin to take hold and certain actions begin to take place? Because now it's impinging upon the comfort and the sustainability of what have been wonderful lifestyles. And I'm talking about also those who decide to move to the coastline. Some of my friends have gorgeous properties here in New England on the coastline. Are they going to be ones who, because they're opinion leaders and have a powerful political voice, might get into this game and really get people's attention more so than those who really don't have a lot of choice?
There's two parts to this. One part is that I think irrespective of your income and accumulation of wealth, when you get, you know, an insurance bill that doubles or triples, when your food prices go up, when you can't get a mortgage, when you have these other bottom line impacts to your household economy, to your checkbook, to your 401k, I think this is when you begin to see greater mobilization as a political means or a political exercise. I think to your question about awareness about climate change in terms of the wealthy contingents or upper class contingents of the United States, and whether that awareness translates into broader measures of political activism, yes and no, maybe in more localized sense, but it also sets up a lot of conflict about, and this is a central conflict, particularly in a local sense, which is, you know, we only have so many resources to go around to advance climate adaptation, climate resilience, or engineering resilience measures and hazard mitigation. To what extent are we going to utilize those limited resources to utilize wealth to protect wealth, i.e. a tax base, right? And at what cost? Do we protect a job or an economic base? Do we think about an equitable distribution associated with social vulnerability? These are all the challenges that are ahead of us. I'm not sure that there's much empathy or sympathy for those who have taken inordinate risks by living right on the beach in Outer Banks, North Carolina, and there may not be a lot we can do about that. But I think on some level, what's very interesting is there's a work by Ossip Bernstein and his colleagues at the University of Colorado and Penn State a number of years ago, really one of the pioneer works in the relationship between real housing prices and climate change. And what they found was that buyers and sellers in high-risk coastal areas and sea level rise zones are discounting the housing in the sense that they're accepting and selling for less. And when they looked at political ideology, it didn't have, as a variable associated with these demographic cohorts, it didn't matter if you were liberal or conservative. It actually mattered what your level of education was and what your underlying wealth was. In the sense that these are, and I think this goes to your point, which is that these aren't necessarily ideologically framed challenges. They're bottom line economic challenges, which are really independent of political self-identification and ideology, and really speak to the idea that, you know, basically the more educated you are, the more likely you are to have forward-looking behaviors that capitalize or account for the risk of climate change in the future. And I think that's where we are, which is that among these cohorts of the wealthy, if you will, for lack of a better framing, we just have greater awareness by virtue of greater education about what this is really going to mean. And I think that leads to its own set of disparities in its own right, and to the extent that we haven't done a good job communicating climate risk to people, even in very localized terms. We talk about flood zones, and you kind of know if you move somewhere as a flood zone and stuff, but there's a whole other realm of more localized climate risk determination that I think that is upon us that is actually going to really diversify or broaden the range of awareness. And I think once that happens, we reach what some may call a Minsky moment, where you have a kind of rapid repricing or revaluation. And I think certainly the wealthy will be caught up in that, to the extent that there's just broader market awareness of this totality of the risk that they have taken.
Well, let's talk about property insurance and the system we have and whether it's misguided, because it has encouraged development in some of these high-risk areas as state regulators demand affordable coverage be offered. I recall after, I think it was Hurricane Andrew in 1992 in Florida,
yes,
where they set up their own state-run company to insure properties. And this is after the private companies bailed because of the risk. So what are we going to see? Are we going to see the government try to insulate those who have invested mightily on our shorelines, and those are some of the most valued properties in our country, just to hold off the inevitable? Or are they going to be building huge seawalls, which are going to be really ugly? I know that was what was talked about after Hurricane Sandy in New York. I mean, where do we go? I mean, play this out for us.
Well, there's a lot here to unpack. I think in terms of insurance, what you raise is a recognition of subsidization by public subsidization of private risk. Of course, that is front and center in the longstanding mislegislation associated with the National Flood Insurance Program, right? So structurally, all flood insurance and flood risk is not actuarially sound for the most part, to the extent that we have deep subsidization. When you talk about wind insurance, and you reference the Florida and Citizens Property Insurance, which is their state insurer of last resort, You have something similar in California as an insurer of last resort for fire insurance as well, something in Texas, et cetera. Yeah, I think this is certainly where we're heading, where states are going to onboard more and more risk on their books and try to manage that risk in capital markets through different types of more, let's say, sophisticated reinsurance mechanisms, derivatives, and the like. But there's only so far you can take, right? But what they're really doing is subsidizing local property tax bases. And, you know, that leads to more systemic risk in the markets, right? So Florida is really one major storm away from being bankrupt, given the amount of liability and exposure. I mean, financial exposure that they've taken on the books relative to, let's say, a Category 5 hitting Southeast Florida and maybe going up the coast and hitting Tampa Bay. Like, that could happen. These storms have certainly happened before. That could totally wipe out all their cash reserves and really put the state on a path towards income tax, right? Florida has no income tax. So, you know, eventually states like Florida are going to need an income tax. But I think what you also raise is the question of where are we heading in terms of, you know, hard material infrastructural logics. Well, there's a lot of places in the country that couldn't afford a wall. And I'm just going to say a wall is a kind of broader typology for climate adaptation. They can't afford it. They wouldn't, you know, a big dike and levee system with pumps and everything, it costs about 6 to 7% every year to maintain it as it did to build it, right? So there's huge operational costs with these things. There's just, frankly, many places in the American coastlines that are not defensible either as an engineering or as an economic proposition, and nor are they necessarily defensible in engineering terms relative to environmental health or ecological health, right? So I think in many places, like Lower Manhattan, where I've worked and spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, really hardcore, intensive infrastructure. Yeah, we want to protect that because we want to protect Wall Street and the financial economy. And by the way, quick note on that: Wall Street's super vulnerable to flooding. The last bank on Wall Street is Deutsche Bank, and they just announced that they're moving. There are no longer any banks on Wall Street. They've all moved up to Midtown, by the way. The only thing left on Wall Street is the New York Stock Exchange, and that'll probably move to Atlanta much sooner or later, where a lot of the back end is happening. So, you know, climate is reshaping our geographies, and, you know, in a place like New York and Lower Manhattan, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to spend $20 billion to shape that with very, you know, well-refined engineering solutions. But frankly, most coastlines of America won't have the material capacity to do this. And what we're ultimately looking at, and this is where we began in terms of climate migration, is thinking about managed relocation or degrees of managed and unmanaged relocation that is both orderly and disorderly. And frankly, this is already happening. But I think it's going to happen on a scale that's really quite unprecedented.
You say in this article in the New York Times Magazine, you were quoted as saying that to picture this scenario of Buffalo, New York, which we consider one of the coldest, most difficult places to survive in the winter, in our minds at least, looking more like Tempe, Arizona, I don't know if you were misquoted, in a few decades. Is that what we're looking at?
I'm not quite privy with that as a scientific statement in terms of the transition of one climate or substitution of one climate to the other. Certainly, it's not going to be that. I think that might be a little bit of a hyperbole, but no doubt Buffalo will have a much more moderate temperature. And places like Buffalo and others are no doubt have their own range of climate impacts, extreme precipitation, water quality on the Great Lakes, et cetera. So they're not immune, but I think in some terms, they're going to have a much warmer, more moderate climate. And of course, that may mean more ice than snow, and ice is much more deadly than snow, so it has its own set of risks, you know. But just in recent years, I don't think Buffalo has actually been able to have its big winter festival because I don't think there's been enough snow. So, you know, Buffalo's climate's already changing. I think what you're quoting is probably a little bit of a hyperbole, but nonetheless, I think it reflects a rapidly changing climate in our lifetime.
Well, let me ask you about another place that it was referenced that you said that Duluth, Minnesota, and I'm watching Fargo now, so Fargo has a lot of activity around that area, is a candidate as a real estate boom market. as these climate migrants, let's say, move north. I mean, I don't know. How did you pick out Duluth?
It's a strange story. What led up to our work and ultimately the New York Times documentary on our work in Duluth. We had really been thinking about various cities. I mean, here's the big picture. There's a great second northern migration associated with people, and part of this is rain shifting. Flora and fauna in the northern hemisphere are moving north. People will follow along, and this, you know, in theory should avail to the benefit of the Midwest, the upper Midwest, and other areas that will have more moderate climate, but also an infrastructural, maybe even a social capacity to handle this new set of populations. And we were really looking at cities not through a process of inclusion, but really a process of exclusion. And others have actually come along and had a more, I would say, refined empirical perspective on this. But Duluth had come up more in qualitative terms. I mean, there's no sort of set of quantitative metrics in universal terms from which we can optimize relocation decisions. It doesn't really work. People are not so simple. But as it turns out, some place like Duluth is really quite remarkable. And one day, frankly, I had mentioned this, and the University of Minnesota called and out of the blue and commissioned us to do more sustained work in thinking about what different waves of population would mean to a relatively small city like Duluth. Duluth is actually quite small, but it was designed for a much larger population. It had a history of mass transit, these unbelievable tram and vernacular systems on the hill. It was really a beautifully designed, it was a lot of forethought in terms of urban design and parks and landscape. Has a wonderful park system, tremendous amenities, a very welcoming culture. I mean, there's brownstones in Duluth that are just gorgeous pieces of architecture and housing that would go for 10 times the price in Brooklyn, even in a crappy part of Brooklyn, right? So, you know, it has a lot of amenities. It has an enormous healthcare infrastructure that really services the region, including, I believe, extending over to Fargo. So it's it has all of the attributes of culture in place and many qualitative aspects. But in quantitative terms, the housing is very affordable. And what is surprised me, I think, more than anything. And the work that we were doing is normative to the extent that, you know, we projected different impacts on the population, you know, displacement, right? People move there and they start to displace others. It drives up, undermines affordability of housing. How do you tap that? How do you grow Duluth in a way that has a sustainable urban footprint? If everybody just moves to Duluth and we recreate suburban sprawl, then, we're getting nowhere. So how can you utilize that new forms of wealth to really think, reimpose that mass transit, think in terms of walkability, sustainability, regenerative forms of architecture, design, renewable energy, et cetera, all of the bells and whistles technologically we have, how do we aggregate that density in truly sustainable terms to optimize human and environmental welfare? So that's what we were really thinking about. And no doubt challenges like climate gentrification would no doubt be a real challenge. No doubt water quality and runoff and all of these things of urban issues. But I think the conclusion we sort of reach is that just experientially, Duluth is just a wonderful place. I was really quite surprised. I'm an East Coaster, like through and through, left coast, right coast. I just fly over these states. But frankly, I just really sort of fell in love in my own. My wife did too. She's a New Yorker, and we just were like, wow, this place is really nice. There's really great people here. It's a cool set of communities.
Well, we'll probably all meet up there at some point in the near future.
Here's the craziest thing about all of this is that people email me with some regularity about having moved to Duluth, not necessarily because of our work, but our work somehow shaped their, or in some cases, people did see our work and they're like, you know what, we're moving to Duluth. That has happened, much to my surprise. But yeah, people are moving to Duluth. I think when the population numbers come out, they'll see that our work probably had a little bit of a bump in terms of recent population. So
the private equity investors, they have called you because of your expertise in this area and expressed their growing nervousness about what are currently really hot markets. And as I said at the beginning of the interview, people still moving to a lot of places that ultimately they might decide for one reason or another, lack of water, perhaps lack of insurability, whatever it may be going forward, that they need to leave. So when private equity markets start recognizing this, banking interests. Again, let's just go back to the practicality of this. What begins to happen in our society that while people may still want to move to Phoenix, they decide it may not be in their best long-term interest?
Yeah, so what's the chain of events by which market economies impose climate risk premiums on consumers that shape their preferences for demanding the stuff, right? But it's also the extent to which these market preferences or risk assignments also shape the supply. And I think that, you know, on some level, first of all, I don't know why anybody would ever want to move to Phoenix, Arizona, but let's just get that out of the way. But secondarily,
sorry to any of our listeners there.
No, listen, Phoenix, I've been there. I'm sure it's wonderful people, and I'm sure there's an environmental component to it of the desert and the like and the dry. Anyway, it just seems like a terrible place. Good people, terrible place. By the way, it's going to be totally unlivable, probably within my lifetime, just about. I mean, and
how old are you?
Well, I'm old enough that I have at least a few decades ahead of me, and I think that in the coming, towards the end of the century, it's going to be excessively hot, and people will be trapped inside and trapped in their cars, and it won't really, really, all joking aside, it really won't be a great place to live, and certainly if you're a working class individual who's working outside, it's not going to be safe. But let's back up to the market economy for a second. So, you know, the way this could very well work is that as we impose these climate risk premiums, first of all, the market's changing, so consumer preferences are changing. We already know this. We already see this in housing. Once, you know, mortgage capital starts to reprice this, once insurance, once other aspects of capital markets impose these premiums, it's going to become more expensive. So whatever affordability challenges we had on the margins are only going to be amplified, and there should be a point in time where that just starts to work in the other direction in terms of bottom line asset valuation, right? That these things become, they're just not good investments, they're not sustainable investments. And that means that, you know, the production of multifamily housing, the production of infrastructure, the implications that has on a tax base to be able to provide continued capital investments in things like moving water around and cleaning water and distributing energy and the like. You know, all of that has an accumulated set of costs that at some point in time, I think, reach a threshold. And that threshold, I think we can understand in terms of consumer preferences, but we can also understand it in terms of credit and creditworthiness associated with municipal and public borrowers, as well as private sector. So I think there's an accumulation here of that transmission of climate risk that is truly systematic. And we're seeing the elements of this now, and I think as it converges, it should amplify that understanding of what the systematic implications will be in terms of long-term sustainability of assets and asset classes.
Well, when you look at it, we've got fresh water and access to it. That's going to be part of the story in the West and the South. We've got these mega fires that we're dealing with in California and now the upper Northwest, and we're told they will arrive in places like Texas, Florida, and Georgia. We also are told that perhaps up to 100 million Americans from Louisiana to Wisconsin will face increasing humidity such that working outside will cause heat stroke. We've got crop yields that are going to be affected in the Midwest and the South. I mean, where does that leave us? I mean, obviously, to those that are below the equator, it's a much, you know, more challenging story, but it seems like a challenging story even for the climate overall in the United States, unless we all end up in Duluth.
Yeah, no one's going to escape this. There's nowhere you can hide. It's just degrees to which it imposes physical, mental, and financial costs upon us. So, you know, I think we will adapt. And even, you know, over time, we should have some type of physiological adaptation to humans themselves and their capacity to heat and cool themselves. I mean, there's frontiers of science from which we just don't fully appreciate our capacity to adapt to climate change, but we can't rely on any of that. We certainly can't necessarily rely on the technology. I think what's important for us today is to recognize what we call path dependency. Is what is the extent to which we are making decisions today that are going to predefine the range of opportunities that we have in the future? And that's where it's worth recognizing that transnational migration, internal migration, the allocation of resources, market risk premiums that will hit our bottom line 401ks. Where, no matter where you live, this is going to impose costs on you. But there's also opportunities, and there's opportunities to think about more sustainable forms of development and housing, greater measures of accessibility, mixed income, housing, and the like. There's a lot that we can do here to take advantage opportunistically of climate change and the reordering of rules and institutions that maybe we can get it right this time. And that's the challenge we have. If we just think about this purely as risk and we don't think about how we can take advantage of this reordering while also having, let's say, an obligation to think about the most vulnerable and along the way, then I don't think we're necessarily doing our jobs as either as public servants or those that are driving the public discourse about this.
Well, in America, though, we have shown ourselves to be pretty bad at pre-planning. I mean, we are being warned, we're being told, we're being shown how difficult this problem is. It's right here on our doorstep. 500-year storms that take place, 5 in 10 years, whatever it may be. And yet we still have a federal government at the moment as we speak that denies that this is something that we need to be concerned about. I mean, how quickly do we need to start getting serious about this issue? I know science will do certain things, but we as public policy folks have to do other things to prepare for this, and we've seen what the lack of preparedness does for us.
Science won't make decisions for you. Everything that we're talking about is about trade-offs. How do you think about net benefits? Science by no means is going to provide the answers of what is the right way forward. And I think that what we need is an imagination of what it is that we're heading towards. What do we want to look like? What is our communities and what is our economy? What do we really want it to be in the future? I think what we lack is a certain creativity. And I don't think the United States is necessarily behind any other country in the world in many ways. And frankly, the federal government actually to this day does a lot of very good work in climate change. I think it's a misstatement in many ways to have a blanket a sort of assignment of ignorance. What we have is a White House that is criminally negligent, if not part of a broader set of criminal enterprises in other terms, right? But, you know, the fact of the matter is there's a lot of laws, regulations, and policies in place that are indeed taking on climate change and climate risk. So I don't want to sort of label an entire class of public servants. And so I think they are doing good work. Are they doing enough? No, but that's a function of executive leadership. And I think certainly in the Biden administration, we will be there and we will advance much more quickly. But frankly, we should have been doing this work 30 years ago, right? So we can only think about the future and not the past. That will be paralytic.
If 8 of the nation's largest metropolitan areas, including New York City, Miami, and Boston, will be profoundly altered, what does that say? Because I know we're in a period, or have been until the pandemic, when young people and a lot of the capital in terms of the intellectual capital of the country was gravitating to these kinds of places. How much are we going to have to realter that? Or in a weird way, has the pandemic done that, where I see a lot of really bright people, and I'm here in the interior of Connecticut, where they've moved back around here and they've moved back to other places because they can do the work from almost anywhere?
Yeah, that's a short-term phenomenon. History would suggest that urban agglomeration, social interaction, it has no parallel, and that technology is no substitute for this. You know, back when the facsimile, i.e. fax machine, came out, everybody viewed that cities were going to die, that central business districts were going to be replaced, because why would you ever go to work when you can just fax it in? So I think these are short-term phenomenon. There's no substitution for this. I think we see the value more so now than we have ever at any given point about the value of socialization, the value of childcare alone. I mean, you know, look at the implications that we have right now for women leaving the workforce. This is profound structural challenges and primarily oriented towards family, other obligations, and childcare. that are driving this. So I think we will have other implications, but I think in terms of cities and urbanization, no doubt they will have costs with climate change, and these will be huge costs, and it will reshape the figure ground of these cities in unique ways. But I think cities will continue to proliferate, and I don't think we're going to see any structural change from COVID at all.
When you were asked by this New York Times reporter, who was looking out of his window in California as PG&E was shutting off power and wildland-urban interface was occurring right outside his window, whether he should sell his home, it is reported, or he reported, that you cut him off and said, yes. Explain that.
Well, I knew where he was going in his preface to what I anticipated was a question. It's something that frequently comes up, certainly on a weekly basis from a wide variety of stakeholders, which is, where should I live? What should I do? How should I think about investment decisions? Or how should I think about transgenerational wealth in land? And these are all very complicated questions and answers that I certainly do not have. But I knew in his context enough about where he lived and the underlying set of risks relative to his age, relative to his underlying economic mobility, and relative to the underlying, let's say, expected value of his accumulated house equity relative to the risk of loss. And it was a very quick calculation in my head that it was too high of a risk to think about sustained long-term investment relative to where he lived.
He said in the article, in closing, you move or you do it when there is no longer any other choice. I guess there still is a choice, but how close are we to people not having all the choices they think they have?
Well, nobody has any choice. We all live. Everything we do is shaped by social media, Facebook. I mean, going back, I mean, let's just step back for a second and recognize we're in the middle of a hybrid warfare with Russia and other state actors, and climate change is very much part of that hybrid warfare, particularly as it relates to information and misinformation. You know, the historic narrative that climate, you know, that oil companies projected all this misinformation, no doubt true, but now we're at another level of truly hybrid warfare from which climate change is one of the token elements here that drive markets and market processes. Believe it or not, it's something that's not particularly well known or understood, but indeed it is happening. But I mean, you know, what is our capacity for rational choice and wealth maximization as consumers in the context of climate change? We have very little control over just about anything that we do. It really fundamentally questions the nature of freedom from which those of ideological spectrum really sort of intellectualize or do not. They sort of project it in pure rhetorical forms. But nonetheless, climate change imposes upon us all of this, a certain burden to question these things about consumption, about the balance between obligation and responsibility. And I think that when you're talking about, you know, do we have choice? Okay, so that's an intellectual question. But the other part of it is, will markets push us out? Will as communities ourselves, we decide to move? That's all interesting. I think we've sort of covered that today. I think there's another element of this, which I'm very interested in, which is people who have the elective mobility themselves to move. And how many people will it be push and pull, right? So some people will no doubt be pushed because their house gets destroyed, but there's also pull factors. And I think as an practical exercise, and maybe even an academic one, I also want to understand the pull side. What's people who have the means, and maybe it's not a lot of means, maybe it's just enough to pay for the U-Haul to get you to Michigan, or Toledo, Ohio, which, by the way, Toledo could potentially be a really interesting place too in its own right. You know, how is it that people end up there? So I think that's the frontier that we're at, is where's the push and pull? Who are the people who have means? Who are the people that get trapped? There's another part of it. Just if everybody starts to move and you see this migration, who are the people that don't have any resources at all to be able to go anywhere? What do we do with those populations, the cyclical poverty traps that we see? How are we going to deal with that? It's going to impose upon us some very difficult decisions that are truly going to be heartbreaking.
Well, I can't thank you enough. Jesse Keenan, fascinating conversation today about when states are no longer habitable or areas. What do we do? How quickly is it upon us? I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, MHNRnetwork.com.